Okay, for those who weren't here yesterday, a bit of recap for you. Yesterday we looked at the why and how of apologetics, and first of all, what is apologetics? It is the defence and presentation. This is how we defined it, or how one guy defined it, Alistair McGrath, the defence and presentation of, how does it go? You've got your notes, I gave mine away. The truth and relevance of the gospel and the great marketplace of ideas, something like that. We looked at four reasons why apologetics was helpful and worth studying. We noted that it wasn't easy. If you come here for a sort of entertaining session, I think it's interesting personally. I think most people found it fairly interesting yesterday, but it's not always easy. Some of it's hard going, and it really needs us to put our mind into action. But we looked at four reasons yesterday. First reason, it helps people come to faith, removing obstacles in their mind. Now, not everybody. Some people raise up tricky questions to try to just get you off their case. But on the other hand, some people do have genuine objections which they wrestle with in their mind, and they just, it's sort of a stumbling block for them, which stops them from coming to faith. And so it helps them. The first reason I actually skipped, didn't I? The first reason it's biblical. There's the example in the scriptures of people reasoning and contending for the truth of the gospel claims. Secondly, it helps people come to faith, removing obstacles in their mind. Thirdly, it cultivates a Christian worldview in our culture. So not just for individuals, but it helps our culture at large remain more receptive to the gospel. And you look at different cultures around the world, some cultures such as in Europe today, the ground is very hard, very difficult. People are very hardened to the gospel, and that has come about. One of the major reasons is because of the total inroads of skepticism and unbelief. Germany was one of the real places where liberalism, discrediting the Bible, telling the Bible that the Bible's a load of nonsense, that was where it really took off, and you see the results of it today. Europe is very hard ground for the gospel. And for that reason, we need to contend for the Christian faith in the public marketplace of ideas and put Christianity on the table and contend for it publicly. And fourthly, apologetics strengthens the faith of Christians and helps them to be more confident in evangelism. Now, I want to affirm what Phil said last night, this is what I was trying to say on the first night as well, in that apologetics isn't everything, and indeed, I said in the first night that Phil's saying all the really important stuff, and what I'm saying is just one small aspect of evangelism. I want to definitely affirm that, and really, you know, it's like just parroting off the gospel, you know, the ABC of the gospel truth, but if you don't have a life which lives it, the gospel, then people are not going to listen to you, you know, for 5 seconds. And again, if you can parrot off all these smart answers and knock down every tricky question which people raise at you, you know, it's a waste of time. Really, the fundamental thing is our relationship with God, and having that. I like what Mark Driscoll says. He has this little phrase which I've heard him pray a few times. He says, "Thank you, Lord, that we share the gospel not because we have to, but because we get to. We share the gospel not because we have to, it's our duty, but because we get to." And if that's, we need to have that attitude in our mind, which comes from a fresh relationship with God. We get to share the gospel. Great. Because we want to. It's the overflow of our life, not because we have to. Okay. Now, to help keep us on track then, here's our little memory verse. This will give us a bit of a kick in the backside to do the hard work, engage our mind, and also to remind us that it's not all just about smart answers. It's about, first of all, setting apart Christ as Lord in our hearts, It's about living a life which causes people to wonder, what sort of hope do they have, this life? And then they'll ask us, what's the reason for that hope? And it reminds us to stop being so proud and to think you're being a smart aleck with all your cleverness, and to stop trying to win arguments, to do it with gentleness and respect. So, let's say it all together. The primary school teacher is still in me, isn't it? Let's say it together. 1, 2, 3. But in your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Peter chapter 3, verse 15. This time we're going to have blue over here, we're going to have red here, black and green. Okay, do you need to have another practice go, or do you think you know your bit? Let's have one more practice go and then you'll be saying your colour. Okay, say it all together first. Go. But in your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Okay. These guys are starting. Then these guys, and these guys. Go. One Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Well done. We're getting there, aren't we? Great. Okay. Now, yesterday also we got started on presenting the evidence for God. And the first one, we looked at five evidences. We're going to look at five evidences. We just got started with the first one, which was called, we could call it the cause argument, or the technical name, the cosmological argument. Now, what I want us to do, why don't we have a review of that, and you can turn to the person next to you, and one of you can be a non-Christian, and the other of you can be a Christian. And if you're a first time here this morning, you're the non-Christians, because you weren't here yesterday. And just play around with those ideas. See if you can, you know, just talk it through, the logic of that argument, and just get, it'll help you revise what it was, and it'll help you just to play around with the words. So let's have 2 or 3 minutes doing that. And if you finish early, swap over. Do it again. So you might start with, how do you know that God exists? Okay, start with a question. So how do you know that God exists anyway? And you must answer using the cosmological argument. Thank you. Okay, that will do. Now, I'd like to hear from someone who thought that their partner did a pretty good job of it. David. Okay. What? Okay. Does anyone want to share what someone said that they thought went well? I heard someone say, well, there's the cosmological argument. Can anybody improve on that? Okay, good. That's basically what it's saying. Steve?
I didn't hear that.
Shelley said that everything that is here because of a cause, and so there must be a cause behind everything that's here. Yeah. Yeah, that's really the... It's everything is here because of a cause. Yeah. 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 Okay. So what you should have said, I mean, something along the lines of, I mean, if you wanted, you can just follow the three-step argument as it's listed there, but it's a bit sort of clinical and very logical and dry, so... What I suggest is throwing back the question and saying something like, well, you know, what caused the universe to come into being? You know, everything that exists, there's always a cause of something. What caused our whole world? If you hear a gun, if you hear a big explosion, a gunshot, what do you say? Yeah, you say, but who shot it? Why? How did it happen? What caused that? There must be something that caused it, and so why isn't that true of our whole world? Of course, the objection to that, which they're going to throw back at you nearly every time, is, you know, you're saying that God caused the world. Well, who caused God? How does that help? Who caused God? And so when we dig a bit deeper, what we're really saying is everything that begins to exist had a cause. Everything that begins to exist had a cause. And then that takes the next level down, and we're saying, well, you look at this universe, and it began to exist. And, you know, you can pursue, we talked about some of the science and some philosophical reasons for why the universe must have begun to exist. So the universe must have begun to exist, but we're talking about God. God, by definition, doesn't begin. He is the uncaused cause, by definition. That's what we mean by God. Okay, but anyway... If you weren't here yesterday, you can read through in more detail for yourself. But that's the first one which we need to practice, get hold of. I don't know if it's the most easy, user-friendly one, but I think it's helpful to be at least aware of it. It might come in handy. I personally like the second one, which we're going to do now. The design argument. Technical name, the teleological argument, but let's just call it the design argument. Just have to scroll through here for a tick. Okay, so the design argument, if you want to put it in three statements like the other one, in sort of in a logical sequence, the fine-tuning or the design, if you like, of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. It's not due to physical necessity or chance. There's a typo in your notes, I think. Design, there goes the argument. So it's supposed to be chance there instead of design. Step three, therefore it is due to design. Now, we're not going to go through the step two. If you really want to get into it, William Lane Craig spends about 5 pages going through that, but I don't think many people would bother with those technicalities, but you can look at it if you like. But it's a very intuitive argument, this one, a very simple to understand argument. It's just saying, look at our world. It's a wonderful world. It looks as if it's perfectly designed for us to live in. Introducing or communicating this argument, I heard Ray Comfort, some of you have heard talking about this week. I've heard him use a really good introduction to this argument, which I thought sounded, works really well. Someone says, how do you know there's a God? We've never seen God. And Ray Comfort says, look at this building. Nice building. Do you know the builder? Do you believe there was a builder? Have you seen the builder? No. Why do you believe there was a builder? Because buildings don't build themselves. And he says, look at this painting. Nice painting, isn't it? Do you think there was a painter? Yes. Have you seen the painter? No. Why do you think there was a painter if you haven't seen him? It's common sense. Paintings don't paint themselves. Except maybe some abstract art. But usually you need a painter to create a painting, don't you? That's the design argument. Things like buildings and paintings don't make themselves. How much more our universe? So I've listed there an authority. We were talking yesterday about Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew was the world's leading atheist philosopher for most of this century. And just about 3 years ago, he publicly declared that he had become a theist. He decided that he did believe in God after years of atheism. All his atheist colleagues accused him of going senile in his old age. That was basically all they could explain it. That was the explanation. But he hasn't lost his mind. He's written a book on it and done interviews on it, and he's clearly thinking fully well in his right mind. And what is his reason for embracing the idea of a God? Well, it's basically this one, the design argument. And we'll talk about it a little bit more later, but the cosmological argument, that didn't really convince him, and neither did the other arguments. Although, as we said, it's very interesting reading what he says about the resurrection of Jesus. He says he's quite impressed by it, but the design argument got him. He said, my motto for life was follow the evidence where it leads. And Anthony Flew is a really nice guy. He's not like, he doesn't come across like these other atheists like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and all those other guys who are very angry atheists, and they're just out to sort of almost kill Christians. It sounds like the way they write. Anthony Flew is a very nice gentleman sort of guy, and he just writes, my motto for life has always been this: I follow the evidence wherever it leads, and I just cannot deny this. And so he says, I believe that there must be a God, if you like, that started our world. Okay. So he's a helpful guy just to talk about, to draw people's attention to. And what I think is useful with the design argument is just to have a few examples in your head. I use this at RE all year this year. Kids would keep on just firing questions at me and just keep on you know, but they want specifics sometimes just to bring it to light for them. You don't say, what a wonderful world. The problem is we are very sinful creatures and we start taking everything for granted and, or, you know how we are, we start grumbling and we don't see God's hand in creation. We need to be reminded of how wonderful our world is. And so I think it's really helpful just to have a few specific things memorized in our heads, which we can just say, did you know this? Did you know that? Did you know that? Just three or four factual things which we can just remind people in a very concrete way of how great God's creation has been. So these are some of the ones I use. My favourite, but I couldn't find where I found it, so I want to find out if it's actually true or not first, but I did read it somewhere. I haven't been able to trace where I got it, but I like this one. Did you know that our eyes send 1,000 million signals to the brain every single second? That's pretty incredible. 1,000 million signals to the brain every second. And we don't think about it, at least I don't think about getting those signals going backwards and forwards. It just happens. Our brains have 100 billion neurons. Now, the problem with some of these big numbers is that they're just big numbers and we forget what these big numbers mean. But 100 billion neurons, each of which are connected to 1,000 other neurons in our brain. And so inside each one of our little heads, there's this tremendous world of people. And I say something like, you know, how many people there that live on this planet? We've got, let's say, 10 billion, a bit less than 10 billion, but let's just say 10 billion. Well, let's say you stuff 10 billion people into this enormous building and you give them all a telephone. And they're all talking to each other in this building. That's 10 billion people. Now times that by 10. So now you've got 100 billion people in this enormous building. Think how big the building would have to be. If you just stuffed in all the people who live on this earth, everybody in India, everybody in Africa, everybody in China, and then 10 times that amount, you've got them all in this enormous building. How big would that building have to be? And then you gave them all a telephone and they're all talking to each other. And it'd be an enormous company. That they were, you know, an enormous organisation. We think some of our buildings in the cities are big. How big must Telstra be to be organising all the telephone networks all over the place? It's an enormous organisation. Well, each one of us has got one of those in our heads, working perfectly without us ever thinking about it. That's pretty incredible. Now, how's this one? This is incredible. The amount of information. Our bodies have got something called DNA in it, which is kind of like a computer program, which tells us how to operate. And our DNA, if you take a pinhead, a piece of DNA the size of a pinhead, how much information do you get into that DNA the size of a pinhead? Well, to write it all out, you would need to get a paperback book, write in it 500, how many paperback books would you need to write out all that information in a tiny size of a pinhead? How high do you think the books would pile? And it's do this with kids, and they say, "Oh, maybe that'd be pretty big, you know, maybe up to your head, or up to the roof." And you say, "No, you'd need it. You need to get a pile of paperback books, all the way from here up to the moon, times 500." For the genetic information. It's the volume of a pinhead of our DNA. Isn't that incredible? So those are very small examples. Then we can talk about big examples. There's at least 45 factors which must be exactly right for life to exist on Earth. For example, the size of the galaxy, the mass of the moon, distance from Earth to the sun, mass of the sun, the Earth's gravity, crust thickness, etc., 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 which permit the presence of life on a planet. Now, the chance of getting all of these 45 factors exactly right Now, you can think of it like, how hot do you need to put the oven on, to turn the knob on, to bake your cake just right? You don't want it too hot, you don't want it too cold. How hot? It's got to be a certain range. How narrow is that range, which everything has to be just right to line up? Or you could say the ingredients of a cake, you know, it's got to be, you've got to have different ingredients, and your ingredients you've got to get in the right proportions. Just how narrow is it? Well, the chances of getting it, of all those 45 things just lining up by pure chance, is less than one chance in 10 to the power of 69. You know, and if you're doing it like in RE, make this visual and you just start writing it. 1,000,000,000,69 zeros. Another one there. If the force of gravity had been less, had been different from as little as 1 in 10 to the power of 100, the universe would have not been life-permitting. Now another one there. I've got, and this is, I think this is it'll be an important one for an argument later in evolution. What do you need for the bare minimum for a cell that will be able to reproduce? The simplest possible cell you can have so that it can reproduce on its own. Well, they've worked out that you could probably get away with this. 387 protein coding genes. So they reckon that that's, you could probably get away with that, 387, so roughly 400. Now, to get all of those protein coding genes in the right order, lining up perfectly with the right interaction with amino acids, one chance in 10 to the power of 5,035. One chance in 10 to the power of 5,035. That's one followed by over 5,000 zeros. This is like trying to guess a 5,000-digit PIN on the first go. Now, that's, any reasonable person would say that's impossible. And yet that is what is required for the first living cell to come together by chance. Now, below that, I've got some stuff on numbers to, which helps put things in perspective with all these massive numbers, and it just starts, doesn't it? After a while, it doesn't mean much, does it, all these big numbers? But to put this in context, 10 to the power of 5,000, how big is that number? Well, I don't think I gave you the full version of this, so you just have to listen. Did I? No, I didn't give you the full version. To put this in context, there's about 10 to the power of 80 atomic particles in the universe. So basic atoms, there's only 10 to the power of 80. 80. If the universe were actually 15 billion years old, as Dawkins believes, this would give about 10 to the power of 18 seconds. If every second and every atomic particle were an experiment in a soup of all the ingredients necessary for the cell to form, this would amount to 10 to the power of 98 seconds. So if you had random cells forming just by chance every single second over 15 billion years, then you would only get 10 to the power of 98 experiments. So this is a long way short of any chance of getting our cell. Let's make every microsecond an experiment. So instead of every second an experiment over 15 billion years, every microsecond we're going to have an experiment. This gives us 10 to the power of 104 experiments. This is not getting us anywhere. Let's make every atomic particle in our universe a universe like our own. With every atomic particle in all of those universes and every microsecond in all of those universes an experiment, we now have 10 to the power of 204 experiments. We're still a long way short of 10 to the power of 5,000. So anyway, we could go on with this stuff. At the end of the day, it's ridiculous. It's just not happening. So I think it's helpful to get hold of some of these. The problem with a lot of these things is that they take a while to explain. This book here, By Design, it's a good book, full of really interesting stuff like I've been telling you. But a lot of it is, it'd probably be a good book to give to someone who is interested to read, but a lot of it is just hard to sit down and, I mean, it's got stuff like, you know, the marvel of the saliva's glands and the kookaburra's beak. You know, let me tell you about that. I mean, that's not going to really, it doesn't have that one, that was a silly example, but you know, it's just got interesting things of creation, which is amazing reading, but, you know, in a conversation with someone, it's going to be just hard to just bring up the kookaburra's beak and, without sounding a bit ridiculous. So there are two or three really good chapters in it, though, with this sort of stuff. But I think the reason why I like these ones is you just memorise a one or two line fact and there it is. It's a bit easier in communicating. While we're on this, I'll tell you about this guy, Michael Denton. He wrote this book, A Theory in Crisis. Not a Christian. He wrote it back in the mid-1980s. And he, because of him, he wrote this. Two or three of the main guys of the intelligent design movement read this book, and that's what really gave them a kick in the backside. Michael Behe, anyone heard of Michael Behe? He's one of the leaders of the intelligent design movement, who argue that they don't worry about the Bible, and say they don't try and prove that Christianity is true. All they say is that evolution doesn't make sense, and there must be some intelligent design behind the universe, and why can't we teach criticism of evolution, that evolution doesn't work, in schools. So that's what they're basically saying. They don't bring Christianity in. You can be a Hindu, you can be a Muslim, and still be part of the intelligent design movement. And this guy really was responsible for a lot of the guys doing it, and this was one of his main arguments. And he's not even a Christian, and he's saying that evolution is a theory in crisis because it just cannot explain the facts. This is how he explains the cell. I know it's boring standing up here reading books at you, but so I'll try to limit this. But he says, to grasp the reality of life as it has been revealed by molecular biology, we must magnify a cell 1,000,000,000 times until it is 20 kilometres in diameter and resembles a giant airship large enough to cover a great city like London or New York. So he says, we're going to magnify a cell so it's 20 kilometres wide, so we can get a good view at it, okay? What we would then see would be an object of unparalleled complexity and adaptive design. On the surface of the cell, we would see millions of openings like the portholes of a vast spaceship, opening and closing to allow a continual stream of materials to flow in and out. If we were to enter one of these openings, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology and bewildering complexity. We would see endless, highly organized corridors and conduits branching in every direction away from the perimeter of the cell, some leading to the central memory bank in the nucleus and others to assembly plants and processing units. The nucleus itself would be a vast spherical chamber more than a kilometer in diameter, resembling a dome inside which we would see all neatly stacked in ordered arrays the miles of coiled chains of the DNA molecules. And he goes on and on, and basically what he's saying is one of our cells is like a little city full of amazing machinery, and I guess that's why the chance of it forming my chance is 10 to the power of 5,000. So interesting. Okay, now what are the objections to this? Well, the obvious objection is, well, sorry, evolution has solved the problem of how we got here. That's not an issue anymore. And Richard Dawkins, he talks about evolution. He almost worships evolution, I think, anyway. He describes evolution in this sort of exalted language. It's almost like this evolution is some kind of deity that we need to bow down and worship, and it can just do anything. Makes these sweeping statements like this on the screen. Evolution by natural selection produces an excellent simulacrum of design, mounting prodigious heights of complexity and elegance. It's sort of like this deity that does all these amazingly wonderful things. And this is how, what I observe anyway, the media just repeats lines like this. And it's just, if you say it often enough, people will believe it. And just, evolution does amazing things. Evolution produces complexity. Evolution does this, evolution does that. And it just, end of story. Scientists have proved that evolution creates miracles. So, what do we say in response to evolution? Well, I've said there, no one denies, I think I've said there, my notes are slightly different to yours. Yeah, no one denies that mutations and natural selections does change species, that species can change. However, natural selection does not provide a satisfactory solution for how life arose. I've listed a number of problems with it, and I suggest try and get hold of one or two of them. And one that's a really useful one is that the origin of the first basic cell, because it just wipes evolution out of the water. And you don't need to talk about evolution anymore. Because evolution cannot explain the origin of the first life, as natural selection could not apply to it yet, in that it did not reproduce itself yet. Evolution only works when you've got something which reproduces itself. And natural selection works by wiping out the weak and letting the strong survive with mutations that supposedly are beneficial. It's just not relevant. So you can say, look, even if, the even if argument, even if evolution was a proven fact that it was possible that, say, humans came from apes and that apes came from whatever, fish came from, reptiles came from fish and so on. Even if that was true, you've still got an immense problem on your hands. The first cell, you haven't explained that. Your whole theory requires reproduction. And that's what got Anthony Flew. And that's precisely what he says. He says, look, even if evolution did happen, you guys, the last 50 years, we've worked out how DNA works. We worked out how the first basic, how complex the first basic cell would have had to be, and it's just not possible. Nor does evolution explain the improbability of the factors required for a life-permitting universe. All that stuff about the distance from the Earth to the Sun and so on, that's just not relevant. And so even if God did choose to create the us through a process of evolution, you haven't really got rid of the evidence of design. It's still there in a massive way. So you don't have to worry about evolution. You know, you can sidestep the issue completely. You can say, well, look, if you really want to believe that God created us through evolution, well, I personally don't think that. I think there's a lot of problems with that. But even if, you know, you've still got massive problems. There's massive evidence of design which is still there. You've still got the first basic cell, 10 to the power of 5,000, one chance in that. Good luck. This is what Flew says. It seems to me, this is his book, There Is a God. And he's explaining why he basically decides that there must be a God. It seems to me that Richard Dawkins constantly overlooks the fact that Darwin himself, in the 14th chapter of The Origin of Species, pointed out that his whole argument began with a being which already possessed reproductive powers. This is the creature, the evolution of which a truly comprehensive theory of evolution must give some account. Darwin himself was well aware that he had not produced such an account. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. Okay, what about evolution by natural selection? Well, the little phrase which the intelligent design people have promoted is this little phrase, irreducible complexity. That guy we're talking about, Michael Behe, he's a Catholic, incidentally, and Roman Catholicism theoretically has no problem with evolution. The Pope said that, yep, that's fine, but Michael Behe says, well, the Pope might be happy with it, but I've got problems with it. And Michael Behe believes in evolution to some extent, probably more than what many of us would, but he does not believe that it all can be explained by evolution. And one of the reasons is because of this irreducible complexity thing. And that is that in so many organisms of life, you've got multiple components in the one organism which all rely on each other for the organism to operate. And he uses the example of a mousetrap. You've got to have a number of components there in the mousetrap for it to work. You need to have a base, you need to have a spring, you need to have a whatever it calls it, flips down and kills the mouse. They all need to be there. If you take one out, it isn't going to work. All the components need to be there operating together, and it cannot gradually come into being. So now people try to, like Richard Dawkins, he really pays out Michael Behe in his book, and he says, oh, you know, he's been totally discredited and so on. But as usual, all Richard Dawkins does is provide surface arguments, and he doesn't really deal with the issues. And so, for example, what Richard Dawkins says, and this is how evolutionists have responded to Richard Dawkins, they say, well, you know, they found, say, in these organisms, there's multiple components which are needed, but they found that some of these components are in use elsewhere in the human body. And so it's not as if these components, this component might have just sort of been copied across at some point in time. But of course, that's quite ridiculous. That's like saying you go into a garage and you see there an old tyre lying up next to the wall, and you see a bit of petrol in a can, and you see a headlight, and so you say, well, all those components are there, therefore a motorbike must be able to make itself gradually. You know, just because the components are there doesn't mean that they can assemble themselves. It's a massive step from just a few components being around used in a different context to them being able to come together and assemble themselves to make a machine work. But that's basically all they say with it. It sounds, you know, they say, you know, this is an easily solved, but, you know, just ridiculously simplistic solutions which they offer. So irreducible complexity is still a very powerful argument against evolution. Now, a few things here. Don't ask me the details on it because I'm not all that great on science, but these are just some things I've written down from books. DNA replication is too good, leading to low rates of mutation. There's not nearly enough time for humans to have evolved from apes in the time given by evolutionists. No unambiguous beneficial mutations which actually create new genetic information have ever been documented. These are to be distinguished from changes which merely alter a system already in place. So yes, mutations come along, they do make changes sometimes, but all that is ever going on is there are changes made to what is already there. There has never been an unambiguous case in which a mutation comes along and it actually adds something totally fresh, something totally new of genetic information. Some mutations sometimes may be beneficial, like you might get beetles occasionally. There's one case, for example, often quoted, beetles were born without wings. That was a mutation. Now, in this particular case, it actually helped the beetles because when the wind was blowing along, they didn't get blown off the rocks where they lived and thrown into the ocean and drowned. So it actually helped the beetles in this particular case to live, but of course that's not gaining genetic information, that's just a coincidental benefit for the beetle, but it's lost the ability to fly, which in the overall scheme of things is not hugely helpful, is it? Okay, I think this one, I mean, this just makes sense to me, the idea that life could have arisen through copying mistakes is just bizarre. No one suggests replacing incubators with X-ray machines to help evolution. Instead, health policies aim to minimise mutations, because we know what mutations do. Mutations destroy. They damage. They don't create life. It's fairly common sense. So just that common sense approach, you know, do you really think that we're going to end up with 3 billion letters of our DNA? I think that's what humans have in their DNA code, 3 billion, and they're going to come from nothing, purely through copying mistakes. Okay, well, I don't know if those will help you, but I mean, there's plenty more. You can go and read the books for yourself, but those are some. Maybe you can grab onto one or two, which makes sense to you. that might help you in talking about evolution. Now, some say, well, Richard Dawkins says this, it would be, you know, sure, it's impossible if you have to do it in one big jump. And he wrote a book, Climbing Mount Improbable, and he says, sure, evolution would be impossible, and it's a little bit like you're at the bottom of a mountain and you've got to get up to the top of the mountain, and it's a sheer cliff. It looks that way. Sure, if that's what evolution is, that's impossible. But what if you can go around back behind the mountain and there's a winding trail which very gradually goes up and very gradually over a long period of time? And so the classic, and he mentions the example of the eye and how, you know, the eye is so complicated. Yes, but Dawkins says, and this is what Darwin himself said, yeah, but what if it started? What if it started as a little light-sensitive spot in a worm? And the more advanced the creatures got, you see that the eyes get more and more advanced. And so some animals, they don't have colour vision and they don't have much detail. But, you know, they get better and better, generally speaking, until you get to humans and they're a really great thing. So you can see that, yeah, it would be impossible for a human eye just to come from nothing. But what if it came very gradually via the worm's eye, then via the dog's eye, and then up to our eye? Well, Michael Behe shows that even a simple light-sensitive spot requires a dazzling array of biochemicals. So they used to think, yeah, light-sensitive spot, no problem, but on a worm. But you look at a light-sensitive spot, and another, you get the microscope out, and it's just another city of technology in that light-sensitive spot. And at every stage, you know, again, it's massive changes and massive technology. It's not a gradual, it's sort of like a jump, a jump, a jump. And so these simplistic analogies, like it's like climbing up a mountain, well, you know, I think a good way of countering these very simplistic analogies, which sound good on the surface, just throw back another simplistic analogy and say, no, I think it's like a blind man trying to jump up to the moon. You know, I think that's a better analogy because that's what the challenge is. That's a better picture of it. Okay. Now, just very quickly through two more. I mean, Richard Dawkins mentions both of these. What about the multiverse theory? So they say, yes, it's immensely improbable. I grant it, life on Earth as we have it now, it's immensely improbable. But what about the multiverse theory? This theory argues that there perhaps are billions of other planets and other universes all going on, all having these experiments of life. And most of them, because it's so improbable for life to occur, most of them... nothing happens, but there's always a chance that it might happen and we just happen to be the lucky one. And so what they're doing is they're increasing the odds by postulating there's billions of other planets all over the place. So that's that one. But as I say there in the notes, this demonstrates the atheist desperation. Imagine a gambler using the argument that the reason why he won the lotto every year in a row, say for 30 years, something immensely improbable, was because there's a universe and he just happened to live in the universe in which by luck he chose the winning number every time. Not much of an explanation. It sounds like a special pleading to me. You need to find evidence that there would be such a vast array of universes to start with. A simpler explanation might suggest that there is some cheating going on. And it's amazing that this last argument is actually used so much, because to me it just seems completely circular. They say, yes, it is unlikely, but unlikely things do happen, don't they? And we are here, so therefore it must have happened. Now, that sounds silly, and yes, it is silly, but on that debate which I was talking about, that argument comes up. In Richard Dawkins' book, that argument is used. Very improbable, but improbable things do happen. We are here, therefore, the improbable must have happened. So, it's crazy. I think it's well illustrated by they often say this. Well, you look at a lotto. Somebody winning the lotto. Is very, very unlikely. It's very unlikely that one person should win the lottery. But one person always does. Therefore, you know, it's possible that it should happen. But it's a completely wrong analogy, isn't it? Because in the analogy of the lotto ticket, there is a 100% probability of someone getting a winning ticket. There is a 100%. Someone always wins. But in a case of life, there's no guarantee that anyone will that there'll ever be any life. So I think we need to move on from that. We've laboured that enough. Okay, we'll go to the moral argument, and we'll move through this pretty quickly. Number one, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Number two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Number three, therefore, God exists. Now, number one, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Now, what we mean by objective moral values is to say that something is good or evil independent of whether people think it is or not. So, for example, if Hitler had won World War II and he imposed his anti-Semitism on the whole world and said that Jews are an inferior race who need to be wiped out, just because everybody came to the agreement that it was okay to be racist to Jews, that would not mean that it was okay, just because everybody agreed that it was. Because racism is objectively wrong, whether anybody thinks it is right or wrong. But if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. If God does not exist, then all we have is human opinion. And what we decide is right and what we decide is wrong. There's nothing objective above us which says this is right and this is wrong. All that is right or is wrong is what we decide is socially acceptable or socially unacceptable. So look at a few of these quotes here by different atheists. Richard Taylor, an atheist: the infanticide practiced by the Greeks of antiquity, killing their babies, did not violate their customs. If we say it was nevertheless wrong, we are only saying it is forbidden by our ethical and legal rules. And the abominations practiced by the Nazis are forbidden by our rules, not obviously by theirs. One guy says, morality is a biological adaptation, no less than our hands and feet and teeth. Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, ethics is illusory. I appreciate it when somebody says, love thy neighbour as thyself. They think they are referring to above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, such reference is truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction. Any deeper meaning is illusory. Bertrand Russell, a famous atheist, says, I don't have any justification for distinguishing between good and bad any more than I have when I distinguish between blue and yellow. There's nothing objective. It's only what the society has decided. Richard Dawkins says, we live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Richard Dawkins had a debate with John Lennox, who's another Christian apologist who does debates. He's actually a Bretho guy in Britain. Do you know him, David? Yeah. He was out here in Sydney doing some debates too recently. But anyway, he debated Richard Dawkins, and at the end of the debate, an interviewer went up and interviewed him, and I found this fascinating. He said, the fact that we have evolved the idea that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that we have evolved five fingers rather than six. Would you, and he's saying, is that what you're saying? Is that what you agree? Yeah, that's about it. Rape is just, you know, the fact that we think that rape is wrong is just something that our evolution has, you know, that's created that idea in us. It's just arbitrary. We might have evolved in a different world in which we thought rape is fine. And really, when you think about it, the whole idea of evolution, survival of the fittest, if we just arose by survival of the fittest, well, where do you get morality from? People, the atheists respond to this and they say, well, we get morality from a sort of the you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. Now, if I go around killing people, I'll soon realize that people don't like that and they'll start killing me. And so life will be pretty unpleasant. And so we sort of be nice to each other so that we all get along and we all are happier. Okay, and so that's where they think morality comes from. Okay, well, that's all well and good. But what happens if in my situation, I'm going to actually be benefited by actually wiping other people out. And I'm too powerful for them to be able to do anything to me, like Adolf Hitler, like Joseph Stalin. Why not under survival of the fittest? You know, this. Why in some circumstances, yeah, in most circumstances, sure, that might work, but there may be circumstances in which the atheist will be able to say, well, I'm going to be actually benefited not by being kind for a change, I'm going to be benefited by stealing everybody's money and they won't be able to do anything about it. So yippee, let's go, survival of the fittest. I'm going to survive. Everybody else will be wiped out. So there is no morality, there's no objective basis for morality with atheism. Second argument, well, surely objective moral values and duties do exist. And the basis for this is just purely our experience. Sure, and you know, all you have to do to really press this point is just saying, so are you saying that these things are just socially unacceptable? They're not actually wrong, they're just social convention that we've decided it's wrong. You're saying there's nothing really wrong with rape. You're saying there's nothing really wrong with torturing people. Do you think there isn't anything really wrong if our government decided to round up all the homosexuals and put them in a concentration camp? There's nothing wrong with that. You know, people say, of course there's something wrong with that. Because we've got this innate sense in us. It's a sense like our, we know as much as good as our perception that what we're seeing is accurate. We trust our eyesight. We also trust our moral sense. Our moral sense is just as strong that there are these things which just horrify us and say, no, that is wrong. Therefore, God exists. If objective moral values exist, then God must exist, because without God, then there's no basis for those objective morals. So, William Lane Craig says in his experience he finds this the most effective argument for the God's existence, which I find a bit surprising actually, but it really connects with people emotionally. So communicating, this is what he says: do you think it would be all right if the government rounded up all homosexuals and put them into concentration camps? You don't have a problem with racial discrimination, wife beating or child abuse. Are these things actually wrong, or are they just social conventions and evolutionary adaptations? Now, a good example of this, which I'm jumping ahead of the notes to page 16, I think this argument, it often comes through in defensive type arguments. And so some people make the criticism, aren't Christians sexist? And this sort of argument is really helpful with a number of these social type of criticisms. And this whole idea of equal rights. Now, people talk about equal rights as if this is something which is an objective fact. But where do equal rights come from other than God? If you do not have God, you do not have this thing called equal rights. So, for example, on equal rights, we might say to them, they might say, well, you guys are so sexist. Aren't Christians sexist? And we could respond, well, Christians believe that God made the sexes equal but different. Well, why do you believe that the sexes should be equal? Where do you get this idea of equal rights from anyway? What's this idea of equal rights that you keep on talking about? I mean, do equal rights, where do they come from? Do they come from nature? I mean, is there something in nature which says that everybody is equal? I mean, just where do we get that idea from? What about survival of the fittest? Don't you say that we came about by evolution, survival of the fittest? Well, how does that fit with equal rights? That seems like complete opposite. why are males and females physiologically different if they're naturally equal? But some people say, oh no, equal rights, that they come from humanity. Humanity decides what are these equal rights, basic human rights, which we have. But since when can we just give ourselves right? Since when can we say, I have the right to be an astronaut? Everybody whose surname is Wilson has the right to park close to the doors at supermarkets. I mean, you just can't say we have these rights. I mean, Adolf Hitler could say Jews don't have rights. And you know, if everybody was an anti-Semite, well, you could say Jews don't have rights. But would that make that true? Would that make that fair? We just can't give ourselves rights. It's just inventing something for ourselves. And so really the only place where you can get them from is something objective called God. And this is how a good little illustration of this, a Presbyterian pastor in the States, Tim Keller. A young couple once came to me for some spiritual direction. How could they figure out if there was even a God? I asked them to tell me about something which they felt was really, really wrong. The woman spoke out immediately against practices that marginalised women. I said I agreed with her fully since I was a Christian who believed God made all human beings, but I was curious why she thought it was wrong. She responded, "Women are human beings and human beings have rights. It's wrong to trample on somebody's rights." I asked her how she knew that. Puzzled, she said, "Everyone knows it's wrong to violate the rights of somebody." I said, most people in the world don't know that. They don't have a Western view of human rights. If there's no God, as you believe, and everyone has just evolved from animals, why would it be wrong to trample on someone's rights? Her husband responded, yes, it's true that we are just bigger-brained animals, but I'd say animals have rights too. You shouldn't trample on their rights either. I asked whether he held the animals guilty for violating the rights of other animals, if the stronger ones ate the weaker ones. No, I couldn't do that. So he only held human beings guilty if they trampled on the weak. Yes. Why this double standard, I asked? Why did the couple insist that human beings had to be different from animals so that they were not allowed to act as was natural to the rest of the animal world? Why did the couple keep insisting that humans had this great, unique, individual dignity and worth? Why did they believe in human rights? I just don't know, the woman said. I guess they are just there, that's all. So, it's quite a useful argument in many different contexts which comes up. Now, the Christological argument is, I think, the most important one, and so we're going to do that on its own in the next session. And finally, the experiential argument, which is what we've talked about a fair bit already. Once I was blind, but now I see. I've experienced God in my life. He's a reality to me. He's changed my life. Now, Richard Dawkins talks about the experiential argument. He just says, well, some people are mad, you know. They're just people in hospital, half the people in the mental asylum, they're going on about religion. He says they have wishful thinking. You know, they really want to believe in God very much, and so they see everything through the idea that God's at work in their life. Says they've got tricks of their mind, and he talks about when he was a kid, he thought he heard this sort of whispering in the walls, and so he thought, oh, I wonder, is that a ghost or somebody? But being the smart little boy Richard Dawkins was, he got out of bed and he went over and investigated, and he found out that it was the wind. And so if you always go and look closely, you'll find out that there's a rational explanation. Ari says it's superstition. Well, there's no doubt that sometimes people do have tricks of the mind and superstitious and wishful thinking, perhaps. But I don't know. I have just heard too many stories which just do not fit that category. And, you know, sometimes I look in my life and I can think, was that God in my life? Was that really? Or was that just a coincidence? And sometimes it's a bit subjective. But, you know, sometimes I see things which I just don't think are subjective. I don't think it's possible to explain it any other way than the hand of God. Like a woman, Karen Pierce, who used to come to our church, she was in a bikie gang. Wild, wild woman. She was in a nightclub. Her little old grandma, She walked in one night to this nightclub. She's a Christian lady, always telling her that she needed to come back to God. She dragged her out of this nightclub and said, "I've got my pastor's here and I want my pastor to pray for you." Karen Pierce, she had been into drugs so much, she was pregnant with her first child and her baby's brain was shriveling up inside her. Going to be born and you know, didn't have any hope. The pastor came over, laid hands on her, prayed for her, and at that instant, she says, she felt this amazing, I don't know what it was, shiver, you know, feeling of release flow through her body, went to the doctor, nothing wrong with the baby. Now, is that wishful thinking? Is that superstition? I mean, this is pretty special. Looks, sounds like a miracle to me. Bill Ford, the last camp, he was telling, he was over in Israel recently, and the family there, they were telling him the story who he was staying with. A Muslim girl, her mother became a Christian. The girl was so angry about it, she said, "I'm going to punish you. The way I'm going to punish you is I'm going to go and buy a suicide vest and I'm going to blow myself up unless you tell me that you've gone back on your decision and you're not a Christian anymore, you're a Muslim." And she said she went and got a suicide vest and she was going to go ahead and do it. And then, however, she came down with this very sudden illness. She went to the doctor and she was told that she had cancer and she had a very short time to live. For some reason, she was terrified about dying of cancer when she was about to blow herself up with a suicide vest. Some people aren't very consistent in their thinking, are they? But she went home and she was terrified. And she spoke to her friend who was a Christian. And her friend said, "Well, I know what I'd do about it if I was you. I mean, I'd pray to Jesus. But, you know, you believe in Allah, so you pray to Allah. But me, I'd pray to Jesus." The girl, she was in dreadful anguish. So she prayed that night to Allah, and then she said, "Well, I'll pray to Jesus just in case." And she prayed to Jesus. She went to sleep. She had a dream. She saw a vision of Jesus. She woke up. She was healed. What do you do with that if you're a Richard Dawkins? Now, I've got my bookcase at home. It's full of books. I've got one whole shelf of books. It's got amazing little stories like that, all different, but all got something amazing like that. God is at work. And you can, I guess, dismiss it like Richard Dawkins likes to dismiss it, but I don't think that explains it. And I mean, those are dramatic examples, but I think dramatic examples are helpful to explain with non-Christians. Say, look, I know a woman called Karen Pierce. How would you really explain that? I mean, I don't know how to explain it other than to say that God is real. I mean, if I was Karen Pierce, I think I'd be fully justified in believing in Jesus. Don't you? Don't you think she'd be justified? And of course, as we've been saying, we need to share with our own experience with Jesus and what Jesus has done in our life. Well, I think I've gone on for way too long. So, high time for a break. So, let's have some morning tea.